Austin Fitz, former Reagan administration HUD economist, and then, what would you say after that? Then fund manager on Wall Street, consultant, writer, and perpetrator of the website Solari.com. Did I leave anything out?
I'm an investment advisor.
Okay, sorry, an investment advisor too. And thank you so much for extending your schedule to fit ours.
Oh, Ian, it's always a pleasure to be on Coast to Coast, especially with you.
Oh, you're very sweet to say that. Now, that having been said, so is there any truth to this? I put a big build up for an hour, and if you just say no, I'll be crushed. But that you told us, you tell a story about being offered the opportunity to meet a real, like, living alien?
I was in the middle of litigation with the federal government, and it had gotten quite dicey.
What year was this?
This was 1998.
What were you in litigation over? Again, I think you told it about, talked a little bit about
it
last
time. Well, you know, it was kind of a, if you've ever seen the movie Enemy of the State, I played Will Smith in real life.
Wow.
It was kind of one of those, you know, irrational squabbles. You know, that when you're in the middle of it, you can't figure out what in the world is going on and why it's happening. Anyway, I was asked by a guy named John Peterson, who runs the Arlington Institute, to come have dinner in the middle of this sort of, you know, unbelievable food fight. And so I got out to dinner, and he said, the Undersecretary of the Navy wants us to do a very high-level strategic plan for them, and I see from the newspapers that you might be available. And I said, well, you know, surely the undersecretary understands I'm having a, you know, this food fight. And he says, oh, you know, the undersecretary understands that's just politics. So I said, okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll help you if you'll help me figure out what in the world is going on with all this crazy business. So I ended up going with him to a whole series of different meetings with the admirals and generals and colonels and, you know, at various think tanks. And finally, after a couple meetings, I pulled him aside and I said, okay, John, what's the gist of this thing? What's, you know, what is our goal? What are we trying to achieve for the Navy?
What did you think it was? What did you think you were doing?
You know, I thought it was just, you know, in a situation like this, when you're doing high-level strategic planning, you meet everybody. So you don't, you know, first you get a feel for the people. So I'm perfect. The undersecretary and his wife came over to my house for brunch, and, you know, so I was just kind of meeting the people, getting a feel for the thing. So I said to John, you know, what's the gist of this? And he said, well, he said, the gist of it is the Navy wants to understand what it's like to operate in a world in which aliens exist and live among us. And I said, well, John, I don't know that. I don't know that aliens exist and live among us. And he said, well, would you like to have lunch with some aliens? And I have to tell you, Ian, I figured, okay, this is where they're finally going to get me, because I was dealing with a terrible smear campaign. So I just, you know, I kind of had that feeling in the back of my mind, maybe I'm being set up. I said, you know, John, I'm dealing with a little bit too much risk right now to be seen lunching with aliens. So I said, are there some books I can read? So I'm a speed reader, so I read about 25 books, and I couldn't make any head nor tails out of it. Because my tool for understanding, you know, for mapping something and figuring out whether it's true or not is money. And, of course, you know, if you're dealing with something intergalactic, money does not lend itself as a good mapping tool. So anyway, so John asked me it was a couple months later, if I would join the board of the Arlington Institute. So I went to the first board meeting, and I have a rule, Ian, that, you know, if I'm at a board meeting, my first board meeting, I'm not going to talk. I'm just going to listen. I'm going to try and learn. And so I walk into the first meeting, and Jim Woolsey,
former CIA director?
Yeah, he was the CIA director. In fact, he was the CIA director when our problem started, and it was funny because he was flipping a pen up in the air. I walked in, his back was facing me, and then John was facing me on the other side. John was chairing the meeting. And John said to me, my middle name is Austin, he says, Austin, it's so good to see you. And Woolsey's pen flipped up and went, you know, halfway to the ceiling and then dropped to the floor. And he looked at me terrified, which is when I realized, okay, my problem really was a National Security Council problem. And I said, Jim, it's so good to see you. You know, these guys never figure that you're going to, you know, live to see them anyway. So he acted real nervous, and I just sat through the whole meeting, and they were talking about whether or not their white paper for that year should be helping the American people come to grips with what it was like to live with aliens existing and living among us. And I'll tell you, Ian, whenever I'm in a room and people are discussing a deep, dark secret, there's tremendous resonation in the room, and there was absolutely no resonation in that room. It was strange.
Tell me what you mean by resonation. I would say resonation for me means that somewhere you can just sort of feel this sort of general agreement or people that could respond to aspects of that story, that could relate to it.
Yeah.
They sort of chime with it.
People were sort of shifting around and feeling uncomfortable.
How about that?
It was strange. What in the world is going on? And a couple years later, well, I guess a year or two later, the litigation just got drawn out to everybody's surprise and amazement. So I moved out of Washington and to Tennessee, where I now live, and I resigned from the board. And when 9/11 happened, I was part of a group of people that did a website called Unanswered Questions, and no one would really look at the black budget. And what I kept finding as an economic matter is you can't turn anything around in a community or in an industry or in the market unless you grapple with the incredible flow of money and very powerful invisible weaponry from the black budget. So if you're going to solve any of the problems that anybody interested in changing things is, you know, whether it's environment or manipulation of the gold market, you really have to understand the black budget because it's at the heart of the economics. So I finally decided normally I would never talk about stories of something that happened in a private board meeting, but I really decided as an ethical matter after 9/11 that I had to, we had to discuss this. And I'm a great believer, that we each have a piece of the jigsaw, and it's very important to bring transparency to the pieces we have and kind of share them and, build a map together. So I wrote up a story and published this. There's an article called What's Up with the Black Budget. And it was interesting. Somebody called me and said, we've talked to John Peterson, who is the chair of the Arlington Institute, and he says, you're a liar, and, that this never happened. And I said, well, you should ask him why he had a liar appointed to his board.
Right.
So there was big hullabaloo. People kept calling me and saying, Peterson and Woolsey say you're a liar. And I just said, look, I wrote what, happened. If it's useful, great. If you believe me, great. If you don't, great. This was meant to be useful, but there's nothing else I can say. Anyway, so apparently I was contacted by a journal of UFOs from London, and they said, well, we're trying to decide who's telling the truth. And I said, I can't help you. This is all I know, and, good luck. And he called me back about a month later and said, well, we're going to publish your article because it turns out Woolsey and Peterson have done this to other people. You're not the first.
So what do you mean done this, meaning what?
Had a conversation with them about aliens and then, then said that they were liars.
Could it be, here's an interesting, could they have been testing you, I don't know about Woolsey, but I wonder whether this guy, John, could have been testing you as you thought, as you suspected, that you felt like you were maybe being set up a little bit, that maybe the setup was they were going to say something like that and see whether or not you would be a leak, whether you would turn around and you would call, a columnist, or you would call somebody in the press and tell them what you experienced, and then they know it was you.
I have no idea. I mean, I have no idea what that was about or what happened. What I will tell you as an investment banker and as an investment advisor, that you can't grapple with the fundamental economics of this planet without dealing with the black budget. And what's really important, a lot of people think of the black budget as very much, covert ways of raising money. And what they don't understand is that the financial side of the black budget includes the manipulation of financial markets and capital markets. And financial fraud is just a very critical part of not just the black budget, but sort of the investment model that the planet is run on.
Well, I was going to say I made some notes on the black budget as you were talking, and I want to get back to it, but I just want to pick a little bit more at this alien story before we get off it entirely,
okay.
Because I think the black budget stuff is so rich that once we get into it, we're not going to want to go back. But I really do. I really want to. I just want to figure. Did they give you at any point an indication when they said aliens live amongst us that we're talking about humanoid aliens that do appear differently? But, you know, I mean, they have gills behind their ears or something like that, but if they wore a hat...
I mean, from the way John said, would you like to have lunch with some aliens, well, I assumed he was talking about people who could walk in and sit down at a restaurant and you wouldn't know a difference.
Hmm. And, or maybe you would be the lunch for the aliens. Maybe that... If you'd like to have lunch with them. But he wasn't talking about Canadians. He wasn't talking about, like, aliens, like somebody from, you know, Paraguay. He meant space aliens.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what I assumed. He would provide me with various books. John Mack's book was one he was providing people with at that time.
Interesting. Could it be some experiment that they were doing to see... You know, here they're doing they said, let's sit down and have a conversation about whether or not the American people could stand hearing this information and what would it be like. And maybe what they were actually doing was using all of you all as a focus group. And they were doing
unknown. There's no way to know. I mean, I have no idea. It was one of the many... It was kind of like sitting down with Jack Kemp when he ordered me to lengthen my skirts. It's one of those many experiences you have when you're in Washington where you just...
Wait, I don't even hear this Jack Kemp story. He told you what?
I sat in his office for a half an hour and listened. I mean, I spent a half an hour with Jack Kemp alone in his office while he lectured me on lengthening my skirts.
What were you wearing? Were you like a beer can cozy, or what were you? What did you have on at the time?
The conversation really wasn't about my skirts. It was, you know, it's all about power. Okay. So and clothing or stuff like. I'll give you an example. One time, and I give Jack credit because he was pretty forthright, and he was a communicator. He called me into his office one time. And he leaned over, he put his hand on my knee, not in a sexual way, just in a friendly way, and he said, I wanted to talk to you because I feel that you are standoffish. And I said, well, Jack, I've received a lot of criticism in my life, but standoffish is not one of them. And I said, why do you feel I'm standoffish? And he said, well, you don't socialize with the other principal staff. Principal staff is sort of the top 30 or so political appointees at the agency. And I said, well, Jack, I've invited the entire principal staff over to my house for a cocktail party or brunch 5 times. And, in fact, I've never been invited back by any of them. In fact, I've invited you 5 times, and you've never come. And he leaned over, put his hand back on my knee, and he said, Austin, I would never come to your house. Your house is bigger than my house. I would find it castrating.
I said,
Jerry Rawlins is the Assistant Secretary for Public Relations. So I said, Jack, you've been to Sherry Rawlins' house because I was there when you were there, and her house is bigger than my house. She was married to Ed Rawlins, who'd been his campaign manager. And he said, Austin, that's not Sherry's house. That's Ed's house. Sherry was married. I wasn't. And, but you have these moments in Washington when you work there where you just, everybody thinks that somewhere inside there's an adult taking care of things.
Right. But you haven't met them yet.
Well, no, you would find it, though. I mean, there would be adults there, but it was kind of it was like the Wild West.
Sure. But maybe when he said that after his comment about how he felt about your house, maybe when he said he wanted you to lower your hemline, you would have said, I'll do it as long as you raise yours. I mean, maybe...
No, what I said was, I said, oh, Mr. Secretary, I respect you so much for your forthrightness, and I will immediately go home and lengthen all my skirts, which, of course, was not true. But here was the reality. I had 7,000 people working for me, and whenever Jack would get really irritated, one would be in danger of being detailed to Alaska. And when you've got, somebody who's a great bureaucrat with a mortgage and 3 kids, the last thing you want to see is that happen to them.
Sure.
So.
How long did you last again under Jack Kemp? Under the
18 months.
Okay. Well, maybe it was
like Bill Cosby says, the life expectancy of a medic from the time he hits the water to the time he almost gets to the beach is 7 seconds. Yeah, no, it was funny because Jack, he would call me into the office and he would order me to do something. You know, there's a scandal, stop this. I want it to stop immediately. And then he'd call my deputy in and say, whatever you do, make sure Fitz fails. And so, the problem was we had to tell the New York Times we were doing the lawful thing, but for political reasons, we had to do the unlawful thing. And it's that switch hit, which causes a lot of the problems. Hmm. And the reality, I mean, one of my big debates with Jack is he kept ordering me to do things that were illegal, and I wouldn't do them.
Illegal in this case, as you discussed last time, was the way in which your office actually interfaced with the black budget. You know, the ways in which money was being moved through your office, which you thought was illegal, according to...
At that time, I didn't realize it was the black budget because I had no idea how significant the black budget was and how significant it was to mortgage fraud. And it's interesting, after I left HUD and then I started my own company, and a couple of years later we get hired back on competitive contract to work as the lead financial advisor for Federal Housing Administration, which is the mortgage origination operation at HUD. And after I got embroiled in litigation, my attorneys asked me if I would dictate into a cassette all my recollections of working in the Bush administration, which I did, which is about six cassettes of 90 minutes each. And I then took that and started to really research deep HUD and mortgage fraud, sort of the Iran-Contra fraud at HUD. And it took years of sort of taking that information and then researching to connect it all up and bring it back to the black budget. So I didn't know then. I mean, it took many years for me as Assistant Secretary to figure out how can all this stuff be going on and me not know.
Well, that's where we'll pick it up then, on how it all interfaces with the black budget and then how the news stories of the last couple of days may be playing into the greater discussion that we've had of the tapeworm economy. By the way, have you seen Will Smith in Men in Black?
No, I haven't.
Ever seen iRobot, Will Smith in iRobot?
Yes.
Okay. In each of those movies, Enemy of the State, iRobot, and Men in Black,
uh-huh,
Will Smith saves a cat. There's a cat scene where Will Smith saves a cat in each of those three movies. And they almost look like the exact same cat.
What's his name?
I've always wondered that. I thought, what's that like where he's reading the script going, what? I'm saving another cat? But for the same actor to have the same action repeated three times, I don't know what it means. Maybe we'll get to that too coming up later on with Catherine Austin Fitz on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Catherine Austin Fitz was unmarried at the time that this guy asked you if you wanted to meet an alien. Could it have been a setup for like a...
I don't think so.
Come on, think about it. Maybe it was this, hey, I got this alien. I think you guys would get along great.
A new opportunity to go road tripping in a whole new way.
Exactly. I think you guys would really hit it off. He's from...
I don't know. At various times, both in the litigation and in the sort of smear campaigns that seem to occur around it, one of the ways they try and, because they keep trying to do something to prove that you're the guilty party or you're incompetent or you're inefficient. And what they'd always do is they try and find something I had said or done that the average person could interpret as weird.
Right.
And then try and make you out to be weird and then unstable.
Right.
And that just seemed to be just part of the game. You know, either coming up with personal habits, and if they couldn't find anything, then they'd try and invent it or, just create this aura of it around you. And it just went on and on. So I assumed that could have been part of it, was to just make me out to be weird.
This is, again, 1998, roughly, when you're embroiled in this lawsuit with the government. And if What would they consider to be weird? I mean, how would they say...
Well, for example, we had in 99 and 2000 very serious physical harassment. That's why I left Washington, was to get away from the physical harassment. I went to a pattern of living in four places on an unpredictable schedule. And we had reason to believe that they were using non-lethal weapons on me. And I...
Who's we?
Just the team of people helping me.
Okay, I didn't know whether it's you and the other voices in your head or something. So, okay, so...
No, I had... I kept on a small in-house staff. I had in-house counsel and a sort of project manager. And, you know, everything was very high-tech, so a technologist. And you know, I won't bore you with all the details, but we were experiencing unbelievably strange phenomena in the house. And I... That's when I started researching non-lethal weapons, because we were clearly dealing with some kind of invisible weaponry, and we couldn't, I didn't understand it. I didn't even know stuff like that existed. And I didn't know the surveillance technology like Echelon or Promisolver existed. And yet we were dealing with all this incredible coordination and sort of, I don't know, if you've ever seen have you seen the most recent Bourne movie?
Sure.
Bourne Ultimatum?
Saw it the afternoon it came out.
Somebody did a great job producing that movie.
But I like that movie.
You see, you know, you're watching it, the intelligence agency team, and you've got like a team of 20 people, and they're all, you know, coming at you from different angles. And literally it felt like we were dealing with something like that. And I couldn't fathom that the world was as centralized as it was until I started to understand the invisible weaponry and the surveillance technology. But I had to back into it. And anyway, so we started to do research. And I had a list up on my article of all the different, both litigation, we had 18 audits and investigations, smear campaigns, physical harassment. I just made a list of everything we'd experienced. And on it was a reference to non-lethal weapons. And in one of the depositions, the Department of Justice tried to make a big deal out of that. And I'm assuming what they were trying to do was just do something that would hurt my credibility.
Okay, I don't know if this will hurt your credibility or not, but I want to say I think you're weird because you thought I would be bored by a discussion of strange phenomenon. I don't want to bore you with the details of the strange phenomenon. What about me or this conversation has ever given you an indication that we don't want to hear details about strange phenomenon?
Here's the thing. One of the things I do believe is that... you know, whatever the truth of the black budget or, you know, extraterrestrial life, a great deal of it is used as, there's a great deal of disinformation, and it's used to keep people entertained and away from really looking and dealing with the power lines that they can touch in their lives. You know, one of the things I try and do is get people deeply interested in how the money works in their lives around them, because there's so many power lines that we could start to shift. So I get worried that some of this stuff, no matter how important it is to what's going on, can be used as a distraction.
Well, is it, I mean, in your experience, I mean, here you were involved in a lawsuit with the federal government, former government official yourself, so you kind of get a taste on both sides of what this is like. Is the government as incompetent as we think it is, or is it competent, so competent beyond measure that they are capable of putting together these amazing surveillance programs or a kind of unified effort to get someone, and yet at the same time present some sort of public face of incompetence to take everybody off the trail?
You know, the great limited modified hangout is that the government is incompetent, which is just not true. I mean, that's just yeah. Although there are many cases where the government is set up to look incompetent, or to the bureaucracy is put in sort of a multiple personality disorder, and so they, you know, you get gridlock and it looks like it's incompetency, but it's really not. So anytime the government's, you know, expected to move and wanted to move, it moves quickly. Now, it's very important, Ian, to understand that in one sense there is no government. What you've got in the federal government is you've got a budgetary mechanism, and you've got an executive branch, which is controlled and run by a combination of defense contractors and large government contractors on one hand and the large banks on the other. So they're really, you know, if tomorrow you became the president, you would not be able to give an order and have it followed up by government officials. You would depend on corporate contractors to implement and large banks to implement your wishes, and maybe they wouldn't, maybe they wouldn't, because your bigger problem is you are financially dependent on the financial markets, essentially, grossly oversimplified, the people who own them. So you basically don't have information sovereignty and you don't have financial sovereignty. So without information and financial sovereignty, there is no government.
Okay, so does that explain weird things like suddenly, no, I really mean this, where Pat Robertson starts advocating for Rudy Giuliani,
yeah,
which I just thought was really odd. I mean, here's, for all of the strong words about Bill Clinton and everything, here's Pat Robertson getting behind a guy who is a known, I mean, admitted philanderer, three times cheated at least and gone through all these different divorces, and suddenly now he's the best man for the White House. And I thought, what? Is there somebody pulling strings behind that suddenly makes something like that happen?
Well, what you've got is you were literally in a situation can I retell the red button story? I know I told it the last time, but it's really worth telling.
I don't get enough red buttons. And in fact, if you want to do some selected scenes from the Poseidon Adventure with red buttons, I'm all for that, too. So go ahead. No, tell the red button story. I think it's really interesting.
In the summer of 2000, I was speaking to a wonderful group called the Spiritual Frontiers Foundation International, who are a group of very committed, spiritually committed people who have a conference once a year to talk about how they can help our society evolve spiritually. And I was giving them a speech called How the Money Works in Organized Crime, which later became my article, Narco Dollars for Beginners. And in the middle of this speech, I was describing the fact that the Department of Justice says that the U.S. economy launders $500 billion to $1 trillion of all illegal funds. So that's everything. That's financial fraud, that's tax evasion, narcotics trafficking, etc. And so I said to this wonderful group of spiritually evolved people, what would happen if we stopped being the global leader in money laundering? So we had a little interactive conversation, and they said, well, the stock market would go down because that money would go to the Singapore and Hong Kong exchanges, and the government deficit could not be financed, and so our taxes might go up and our government checks might stop. And I said, okay, well, let's pretend there's a big red button up here on the lectern, and if you push that button, you can stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your community, your city, your state, your country tomorrow, thus offending the people who now control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of money laundering and the accumulated capital for many decades thereof. Who here will push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, guess how many would push the button?
I took this test last time, so I know the answer. Go ahead.
One would push the button. 99 would not. So I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? And they said, we don't want our mutual funds to go down, and we don't want our government checks to stop. And that's what I call the red button problem, because it's funny. I was up at Bioneers in Alaska several weeks ago up in Anchorage, and I told the story and asked the same question. And here's a group of 200 people committed to creating sustainable communities. It's 7 years later, and 50% of the audience would not push the button. Now, if you're the President of the United States or the Congress, how can you push the button if the population won't?
Well, so tell me how that informs that, the proposition there that we were just talking about. I mean, how do you see those two tied together?
Well, what it means is if you're the President in the Congress, if you're whoever is running the federal government, the will of the population is they want another check, and they want you to go borrow money to finance that check, and to borrow that money, you have to go to people who control organized crime, essentially, and whose business is warfare. So you're kind of between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, but I mean, again, I go back to, I look at somebody like a Pat Robertson suddenly endorsing Rudy Giuliani. Is it just then that he sees, in your opinion, the writing on the wall? He's gotten some sort of memo, or somebody's, you know, rubbed their, you know, index finger against the tip of their nose, and they know, the fix is in, it's Rudy, so he might as well get behind him so the checks will keep coming? I mean, how does that...
Here's how it comes down in an individual situation, and who knows exactly what the truth of, because, you know, there are 1,000 variations on a theme. But do you know what a control file is?
Don't think I do know.
Okay, a control file is, remember J. Edgar Hoover and the Dirty Pictures?
Sure.
Well, Jack Kemp used to always call me and he'd say, I can't find the dirt, but I'm going to look for it. And when I do, you know, you're going to be in trouble. And I'd say, Jack, you're never going to find it. It's not there. And he'd say, it's always there. I'll find it. A lot of political and business leaders who go beyond a certain level have a control file. Or they're subject to relationships in a network where if they don't do what they're told, they're going to experience violence or the kind of situation I had where they couldn't find it. You know, they tried to find something. They tried to frame you. It didn't work. You know, but it took 12 years and $6 million to get, you know, to get through it. So people don't want to, you know, they can't deal with that level of force and coercion, even if they're perfect. You see what I mean? So essentially, people have skeletons, they have needs, they have practical situations, and you're in a situation where an honest business or government leader can't say no. I mean, if you look at my situation, who wants to spend 12 years and $6 million, you know, trying to prove that you're clean?
Right.
I mean, I was able to prove that I was clean, but it took a great deal of time and money. So it's a very dangerous situation that people are in.
What was the contention? What was it that they said made you dirty?
Well, what happened was a whistleblower, it's called a QUITAM lawsuit, a whistleblower filed a lawsuit, and under the law, they file it, and there's 60 days to produce evidence whereby the Department of Justice investigates, and if there's no evidence, then it's unsealed. So this is under seal, so the person who's accused can't see it. Well, what happened was they found a way to circumvent the disclosure provisions, and they kept it under seal for 4 years. And for 4 years, we were, you know, we went through audits and investigations. And it took 4 years to get it unsealed. And it turned out, once we got it unsealed, they knew there was no evidence. They were just hoping that if they drew it out long enough and, you know, investigated hard enough that they'd be able to find a couple parking tickets, which they were never able to do. The judge in charge of the, you know, under the law, you can't keep it under seal for 4 years without evidence. The judge was the former general counsel of the CIA, Stanley Sporkin. And it's now, if you go to my website, there's a story where I tell the whole story called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of stock profits. It's kind of a case study on tapeworm economics. And the power of the story, Ian, is it gives a great case study in what you and I have been talking about, pump and dump economics and tapeworm economics. But it also describes the story of how the housing bubble got started. Because essentially, to get the housing bubble started, they had to throw the honest people out. And it's these kinds of dirty tricks and, you know, situation. I mean, these are the tactics, the sort of economic warfare tactics that are used to get the good guys out.
Well, then, that brings us back to a couple of things. I guess we'll, in the time that we have, I'll just ask about this. Story this week, devaluation of the dollar. And as soon as I heard that, I thought, is that another sign of the tapeworm economy, where we're in the middle of an economic pump and dump, and this is showing again, because there are other economic indicators that say that the host body is doing just fine. Where are you with that?
I think that the host body is in real serious trouble. What we've been doing is we pumped up the economy using massive amounts of debt, government debt, consumer debt, mortgage debt, starting in the mid-90s, and as part of that process, we built a situation where the dollar got a much bigger market share of the reserve currency worldwide, and as we did that, we pulled tremendous capital, my estimate is about $10 trillion, out of the United States and moved it into the emerging markets. Now, there's a lot of economic sense to that, in the sense that we have an aging population and our productivity is falling for a variety of reasons that could be changed but aren't. And that money was moved to primarily to Asia, but populations that have a much younger average age and are rising in productivity. And so we really financed that shift by hawking the consumer and the citizen, if you will. Because if we had tried to do that shift without the debt bubble, everyone would have felt the pinch and the squeeze and the liquidity. So we bubbled the economy. The dollar drove up, and so we moved the money in abroad at very cheap rates, particularly because liquidity got pulled in Asia and Latin America and other places. So we bought cheap with high dollars. But the debt is now coming due, and the fragility of that situation is becoming obvious. The need to borrow more and more money is it's funny. I was at an investment conference in London in about 2002, and this investment manager stood up under all the portraits of the ancestor, and he says, "You better hope aliens exist, because we've borrowed all the capital on the planet, so the only way we can get more capital is to go off-planet." It's destined that the dollar's going to come down, and the question is how far, how fast.
Well, I'll ask those questions coming up next with Catherine Austin Fitz, who doesn't have anything dirty in her control file, right? You have nothing in there? Because you can borrow some of mine if you want, because my file is a little thick, I think. And they could probably, you could use some of my pictures if you want. Then we'll pick up this conversation coming up next hour. And it's an hour away from your questions and comments, but we'll get you in there, I promise. And we haven't gotten back to the black budget, but made lots of notes earlier in the conversation about that, too, because that was something which I think we could have explored more the last time that she was on with us. But let's talk about the devaluation of the dollar and other economic indicators. Does it confirm that the U.S. economy is in the midst of having been pumped and soon to be dumped, with corporations moving into other countries and the super wealthy leaving the country altogether? On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Let me throw that at you. It seems like that's sort of something we keep hearing a lot about, is whether it's the lead paint on children's toys or products that are being imported from China that have, you know, some sort of level of toxicity to it. What do you hear in that? I mean, is that just a weird coincidence, and it's just that it keeps being China, and we should not think of it as anything more than that?
And I've never researched the individual cases, because it does, you know, part of economic warfare is, in fact, those kinds of situations. But we are in a long-term transition from having centralized control work through energy to centralized control work through food and water. And as part of that, you're seeing constant articles and drumbeats about food safety that are used to ensure more centralized control of food. So whenever I hear a food safety story, I'm always very suspicious.
That it's going to mean what, another government agency, or?
More rules that will benefit the large provider.
Okay.
So, for example, I have an article about the National Animal Identification System, NAIS, and the application of digital technology, in essence, to the all livestock, and the extent to which that puts the small farmer at tremendous disadvantage and gives amazing control, potentially, to the federal government. So, anything that increases centralized control generally works against, and you know, both markets and freedom.
Well, if we're talking about the internet and centralized control, I go back to a question from the first hour. Somebody said they're very concerned about all of these websites and stories that are almost exclusively on the internet, by the way, showing these large, in some cases outdoor, tent-based prisons that are being thrown up by the U.S. government, being ready to warehouse people Where are you with that?
I don't know anything about it. I've never seen one. I can, if we're dealing in a situation where the financial system is very unstable, and I can see why a government would be concerned over issues of massive immigration or what would happen if law and order broke down, but I really don't know.
Okay. I'm with you on that. I think that's generally, I don't know either, and I keep getting conflicting information about it, so I'll hold that open for now. Now, but back to what we were talking about, which is the devaluation of the dollar this week. Explain to me, because I'm the dumbest guy I know, what does that mean? And like, how can who decided that the dollar is worth less? Doesn't the dollar decide? I mean, doesn't the market decide? What happens?
No,
what's the story?
The military decides. if tomorrow our military and nuclear capacity and various invisible weaponry went away, the dollar would reprice to about 10 cents on the dollar. Most of the dollar's value comes from its the fact that it is so large, everybody's in it. So it's the reserve, or it has been the reserve currency. But we also have the ability through both covert and overt warfare to force our will on people. So, for example, when I hear a country threatened, what I hear is, you know, not the threats that are in the paper, but if you don't buy more treasury securities, this and this and this is going to happen to you. So we're watching the perfect fusion of economic, political, and military warfare into one. The value of our treasury securities and the value of our currency at this point are highly dependent on force and our military capacity.
So then how did the dollar get devalued?
Well, the dollar is dropping in value because our financial situation is the U.S. government is essentially bankrupt. Now, I'm being imprecise to say that because for 10 years the federal government has refused to produce audited financial statements, and I believe that there's very good sort of indications to indicate that the finances that they are publishing are very different than what is actually going on. So we don't have reliable financial information about the federal government finances, but even what exists indicates that it's bankrupt. So we're borrowing tremendous amounts every day to keep spending money on things that don't create any productivity whatsoever. And we now have an economy, the economy of every county in this country is deeply dependent on financial flows from the federal government. To give you an example, if you look at the municipalities across the country, we have municipal governments that are very dependent on the flow of property taxes and fees from, you know, essentially from real estate transactions. And as the housing bubble slows down, that's going to ramp down. And then they're very dependent for federal flows. And those monies come from borrowing money. And as the dollar drops, the cost of borrowing that money is going to skyrocket. And it's even possible to conjecture that it's not possible to borrow that money. The world's not willing to provide that money forever. We're literally in a situation where the red button may be pushed.
I saw a story about how, I think it was Los Angeles, had seen their city revenues go down for speeding offenses, for traffic offenses, because of the traffic cameras that went up. That the traffic cameras went up, and they wrote a certain number of tickets for the, you know, for going through the red lights and stuff. But then afterward, what they noticed was just people started actually following the street lights, and they knew they were on camera, so they slowed down. Now they're going to have to come up with the money that they're losing from the revenue from having put up the cameras, and it's causing somewhat of a crunch, because now they weren't somehow expecting that they'd be getting less money from putting the cameras up, and that's
right.
Sort of the law of unintended consequences.
I don't know
what it's a metaphor for, but it seemed like a really good metaphor. I just didn't know for what. It sort of seemed typical somehow of short-sighted government work when it came to money, and that it seemed like a lack of integrity on the part of that they weren't being about just one thing. That if we're only about getting people to slow down and obey the law, shouldn't they be dancing a jig that they don't have the kind of revenues they had from the speeding tickets?
Well,
but they're not.
We're increasingly building an economy where we make money from other people's failures as opposed to other people's successes.
Well, okay, though. Well, this is good. This is the metaphor I was looking for. So,
uh-huh.
So tell me what you what like.
Well,
like,
I use the popsicle index. Do you remember the popsicle index?
Right. Right.
The popsicle index is the percent of people in a community who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So when I was a little girl, the popsicle index in West Philadelphia was 100%. It was unthinkable a child couldn't run up to Spruce Street, buy a popsicle, and come home alone. And the Dow Jones was, at that time, about 150 to 500. So the Dow Jones is now over 13,000, and the popsicle index in my old neighborhood is much lower.
Well, yeah, because people even... And maybe it's true that you can't safely send a child up to get a popsicle and come back, but there's a perception even in small towns in middle America where the child is still almost guaranteed 100% return, where the popsicle index may be 60 or 50, 50%
of the time. I live in a beautiful little town, and the popsicle index is certainly not 100% here.
Right. What do you think it is in middle Tennessee where people are really relatively safe from anybody driving through and taking their child?
I think from what I see here and across the country, but it's true here, but it's everywhere, kids aren't safe here for a variety of reasons. One big one is the drugs. There are very significant drug business presence, and as a result, you have gangs and you have a whole culture which really is not safe for kids.
Huh.
So I would say the number one problem in terms of safety is drugs and drug gangs, or, you know, throughout rural America, wherever I've been.
Well, that's true for Tennessee. At least when I lived there, it was true for Chattanooga because of it became sort of a way station for the gangs coming up from Miami, and that's why Nooga became such a hotbed for a while. I don't know if it still is.
This gets back to the black budget.
Yeah.
Because again and again, when you see a group of sort of soccer moms organized to back the drugs out of their neighborhood, they run into the Linda Ives problem, which is, you know, James Bond is protecting the drug lines, and it's so centralized that one neighborhood can't clean it up.
Well, let's talk about the black budget then in greater detail. For the sake of definition, the black budget is the actual amount of money that never appears in an auditable form for the U.S. taxpayer, or for that matter, the majority of people in the U.S. government.
U.S. government. Remember, a law was passed in the Bush administration requiring audited financial statements. The federal government has never complied, ever. So we don't have audited financial statements at the federal government.
There are books that come out every year that say this is how much this agency has to spend and this is how much that agency will have to spend.
Right.
We have that.
Let me give you some idea of the magnitudes. And I looked it up for Minnesota because I know you live in Minnesota.
There you go.
When I did these figures, the April 2000 census said that there were 4,919,479 people living in Minnesota, residents.
Okay.
They paid $42.8 billion in IRS individual taxes, not corporate, just individual. And that meant their taxes per resident in 99 were $8,694.
Okay.
And in the following year, the proposed appropriations to federal agencies without reliable financial systems or audits per resident was $7,506.
I think you lost me on that last one. What did that mean?
So if I live in Minnesota and I'm paying $8,694 a year on average taxes per resident, and of that amount, about 80%, 84%, $7,506 is going to agencies that do not have reliable financial systems or audits, then the majority of the money I'm paying into the government is going down a hole. As of 2001, if you looked at the amount of money missing, undocumentable adjustments in the last 4 years, it was $14,000 per resident. So say for the average household in Minnesota, that's about $50,000 per household is missing in 4 years from the federal government.
And we say missing, but very likely it's being used for what?
Well, that's the $64 question. In 1997, when I gave a presentation to a group of pension fund leaders, we talked about this the last time, and described sort of my vision of how we could radically improve productivity and protect the middle class in the United States. And the head of the largest pension fund in the country said to me, you don't understand, it's too late, they've given up on the country, they're moving all the money out in the fall. And that's when the money started to go, that fall was when the money started to go missing from the federal government. So, I think part of the question is, have we seen a situation where tremendous debt has been issued, including off balance sheet, and that money has then been shifted to invest abroad? Because I don't think whatever it is, it's just in sort of black budget items. I think we're looking at a significant reengineering of how the planet and assets on this planet is governed. I think essentially what you're watching is the reengineering of government. We're shifting control and ownership of assets out of governments and into corporate and private investment hands, and shifting towards a one-world government. But that one-world government is really, a governance system where corporations rule, not governments.
A corporatocracy. Let's tie that back into the first conversation we had about your experience when somebody came up to you within the government and said, "Do you want to meet an alien? Do you want to have lunch with an alien?" Could it be that somehow all of those stories are tied together?
Well, it could be, but I've worked my whole life in business or government. And what I've watched for that whole time is steadily growing organized crime and a steadily deteriorating culture. And the reality is you can't, what you've got is a group of people who are using invisible weaponry and technology and sort of, secret societies. And they're running the world in a very different way than the rest of us think the world works. And, you sort of got these, grossly oversimplified, two cultures, sort of insiders and outsiders. And the insiders get more and more bold and more and more bold. Where does it go? And I think part of it is for 5,000 years, we've had, the English-speaking people or the European people, whatever you want to describe it, our predominant model has been warfare. And it's been a very successful model. I call it the sort of central banking warfare model. We print money, and then we have a military that gets everybody to take it. And when we need subsidies to keep the model propped up, we just, steal land and kill people. And it's worked. But the reality is we're coming into the end game because we have significant, we're globalizing, we have very sophisticated technology, we've got 6 billion people, and that model can't, if we're going to live in this planet in harmony, that model can't continue without
right.
being very ugly.
If just the average schmo wrote that to me in an email, I'd say they were crazy, but when you say it, it sounds totally convincing. It's Catherine Austin Fitz. We'll pick it up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Hey, Catherine Austin Fitz, have you ever heard the theory that one of the causes behind the Protestant Reformation was the discovery of the New World?
No, I have not.
The thought is that the two events are connected, the 1492 adventures of Columbus and the popularization of this whole new world that existed out in the ocean. And the fact that the Catholic Church of the early 16th century became destabilized with people who were willing to question authority, saying, look, you never said that it was there.
Well, I thought it was the printing press.
Well, you have Gutenberg's Bible comes along in it, but it isn't that originally.
Well,
I mean,
Leif Erikson and Scandinavians were in North America way before Columbus.
Sure, but it wasn't popularized. And the thought is that the question became, and we'll never really know because we don't have surveys to back it up, and there wasn't a lot of popular discussion of it, but there's just this thought that that was such a ground-shaking kind of event, that there was this whole new world, and that there was already people were thinking about going there, and that the church had never told people that it was there, that they think that maybe there's something to that. The reason I bring that up is I think about what would happen, and since the very first conversation we started to have tonight was about the approach that had come to you about being involved in a committee meeting about talking about what would happen if the American people knew that aliens were living amongst us. And I think the question is, would it shake the earth? Would it make it, would it so mess up everything that it would be in the government's best interests to keep that information away from the public so that the money keeps flowing either down this black hole that you talk about or to the corporatocracy that is behind the government, that it would ruin the consumer, or it would freak people out too much that the economy would never be the same again and they'd stop being able to siphon off as much money as they have. Any thought on that?
I think that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the reality is if a group of people can get away with something and it's to their advantage in terms of power and money to get away with it, then they will. And we're in a situation, regardless of what the truth is, where essentially the crowd is not able or willing to enforce good behavior. Another way to say it is the crowd supports the criminals. So we have a situation where literally a relatively small group of people can get away with murder. And the question is for the rest of us is what do we do about it?
Well,
I think that the problem is you've got a real imbalance of power going on in our culture and in our society.
Well, I just wonder what would happen. I mean, to go back to that original conversation, I wonder what would happen if, to our economy, if the American people were told, okay, yeah, by the way, there's aliens everywhere. And nobody cared. And nobody cared. Everybody was like, oh, cool, let me see the ship and show me your ray gun and like, oh, neat, can you make that vaporize? And they actually didn't care. And I wonder what would happen and whether or not there is whether there really is an effort.
Here's the problem. You know, I don't know that aliens do exist.
Right.
I don't know that. In my personal experiences with good old-fashioned organized crime and government corruption.
Right.
So my personal experience is pretty mundane. It's clear that we don't, it's unnerving. We all live on a planet, and it is clear from the information we do have that we don't have a good map of what's happening and why. We don't have a good picture of our reality. We go to school and spend, you know, enormous amounts of years in a school, and we don't get an accurate map of our world. And I think we all find it terribly unnerving. But the reality is we don't know what's going on, and it's clear. Well, I mean, I don't think there is a government. I worked at the highest levels of government, and what I saw was the Wild West. I didn't see a government as people, you know, as you see when you watch TV.
Right.
It was warfare. It was economic warfare, and it was scary because it wasn't always particularly adult.
Is the hedge against that gold?
Well, I think there are many different things that a person can do to protect themselves and their assets. And the first and most important is family and community. When the litigation started, it turned out, I counted it up, I had lent $250,000 to friends and family, and that was the source of money that the Department of Justice and sort of the situation could never shut off. And if it hadn't been for that money coming back, I wouldn't be alive today. And so, friends and family turned out to be a much better investment than gold or anything could possibly have been. So I would say friends and family are first. The second best investment, I would say, is to get your overhead way, way down. And the more you can build your skills and your network to be self-sufficient, the better. I'm a person who used to have a very high personal and professional overhead, and now I operate at a much lower overhead because that's really freedom. Anything you can do to get your debt down as well is terrific. And then finally, there's no doubt about it, precious metals are a great way of protecting your assets, and it's also really a vote for freedom, because one of the biggest issues, we've been watching very significant inventories of gold moved out of private, out of governments and out of central banks into private hands. And I'm assuming that it's being accumulated and stockpiled, for the purpose of going to, regional currencies and then one world government and currency. And so one of the greatest votes for freedom I think anybody can make is to buy silver and gold and keep that inventory decentralized.
Yeah, but
as we've seen the price of gold skyrocket over the last couple of years, it's really not gold that's changing in value. That is a sign of the dollar dropping in value.
Well, I don't want to be a fear-mongerer, but if you're right when you say that it is only because of the military that the dollar has value, then wouldn't it be in the best interest of government to at some point just merely confiscate the gold or invalidate anybody else's private use of it?
Well, when confiscation happened in the 30s, gold was a very significant part of the personal wealth of Americans. Now it's unfortunately de minimis. And so if you confiscated gold, you would confiscate from the most noisy, irascible part of the population, and you get very little. The more likely thing to be confiscated is capital controls and 401k plans, but it would be very subtle. We've seen over the last 10 years, enormous, and 20 years, but really last 10 years, enormous restrictions placed on investment flows for Americans, and I deal regularly with sort of investment options available to Americans and then investment options available to people outside the country. And Americans have significantly poorer investment options and choices than a non-American or, say, a European. And that's because you've seen very, very subtle rules and regulations that all pile up, really come up to capital controls. I'm a member of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, which is a group of people who've lobbied and tried to educate against the suppression of the gold price and the manipulation of the precious metals markets. And one of the things that we are in the process of doing is trying to find out what has happened to the inventories of gold in the government, and really trying to stop the kind of manipulation of the gold market. In the process, we wrote a letter to Treasury and said to them, would you confiscate? And they wrote back and said, we reserve the right and power to confiscate not just gold, but all assets. If you go to our website at GATA.org, GATA.org, you can see that letter up on the GATA website.
Naomi Wolf is a popular writer, and she is most often known for kind of being left of center on social and political views. So I'm not sure what to do with this other than just to, stipulate that up front. But I was talking to a friend who watched a video that she has on YouTube in which she says that right now the United States is almost in the exact place that the Weimar Republic was in before Adolf Hitler. that we are...
Well, what you're watching is, and this is where the Weimar Republic, you know, it's not an inappropriate comparison. You were watching a country in trying to inflate out of its debt problems, and as that happened, you got a skyrocket in the value of real assets. You get an inflation effect in the stock market, and that's kind of what we've been watching. And so it's not an inappropriate comparison. One of the people in the gold market who I think is the best commentator on what's happening in the gold market is James Turk. And I was just down at the New Orleans Precious Metals Conference and heard Turk's presentation, and he described it very much as a certain period in the Weimar Republic before it, the finances fell apart. Now, I don't see what happened there to happen here, but the reality is when your financial situation becomes this dire, the more you spend, the more you watch your freedom go away. And there's literally a correlation. I think Ron Paul's been saying this in his campaign, that, you know, the more the government spends, the more we lose our freedom.
Well,
so,
when Naomi Wolf says that, of course, I think we have images of people, you know, post-World War II or in Russia, you know, with giant wheelbarrows full of cash to buy a loaf of bread.
Well, the difference between the Weimar Republic and now is globalization, new technology, and globalization are very, very deflationary. And so one of the things, you know, if tomorrow we woke up and found ourselves as the central banker, one of the things you're very afraid of is an inflationary spiral, but the other thing you're afraid of is a deflationary spiral, and both are a possibility. And the, you know, the most important thing you can do in helping a family plan for the kind of uncertainty we're dealing with is to make sure whether it's a deflationary spiral or an inflationary spiral, you're fine. A deflationary spiral would look like 1929, where you go into a depression and income and expenses fall, but income, you know, falls faster. Right now what we're looking at is, Ian, is a situation where for the average family, the incomes are falling and the expenses are rising. So it's a squeeze, and that squeeze has been protected by the increase in asset values, i.e. my home's going up, my land's going up, which has come from the debt bubble, and now that's turning. And so now we're going to see incomes falling and expenses rising, even if we're in a deflationary spiral, because what we've got is we've got exploding populations and limited resources of certain kinds, food, water, oil, etc. So a great comment was the investor Jimmy Rogers, when asked if he was worried about peak oil, he said, forget peak oil, it's peak everything.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because we were just talking about, I mean, obviously the guest we're going to have on originally tonight was about water and about the Great Lakes and the number of other states. I think it was even the Democratic candidate for president, Richardson, said that that Wisconsin was awash with water. That and making it seem like these, you know, states in the upper Midwest had no right to claim, you know, all of this water, and that it should start being pumped around to the rest of the country.
One of the things that just, I want to cry every time I see it. I just went, in fact, I just went through all the Minnesota pension funds this morning to see where they were invested. You literally see the big pension funds and everybody's 401k in a state financing, you know, the big banks are buying stock in the big banks at the same time that private corporations are moving in and buying up their farmland and their water. The best investment we can make in a county or a state, the state pension funds, is to lock up that water and that farmland, because that's what's going to have real value. So we're crazy to, you know, to be investing in large corporations and let the most precious assets we need get bought out from under us.
Well, and how do you do that? How do you buy a lake? I mean, what do you mean by that? I'm not. How should we invest in? Let's say you have a county in Minnesota where there's, you know, 10,000 hockey rinks. What do you do with that? That's what we call
it
here in Minnesota.
Well, it depends on how the water and land is owned now. But, for example, there's a town in California, Mount Shasta, which is famous for its water.
Right.
And they're having a huge squabble because Nestle's been running around the country buying up, you know, all the spring water and different areas with special water and water, you know, spring water companies. And they're having a big fight because Nestle's gotten what appears to be a fantastic, you know, a below market price, good for 100 years, in a structure where apparently, according to the town, if they run short of water, Nestle gets the water and the townspeople don't get the water, which is a very serious issue because, you know, we now have a town in Tennessee that has literally run out of water. Our drought was so bad this summer.
I heard about that a little bit. That was that kind of a small town, but
right.
the mayor was on Good Morning America or something talking about that. I caught a little bit of it. But buying it, I mean, getting together and buying resources means, you know, that you keep it from being sold to somebody else, that you make sure that it's fully funded.
Right.
Okay.
Well, in 19, you asked why the enemy of the state happened to me and my company. We were putting together venture funds, and we're prototyping venture funds whereby communities could raise capital and finance themselves in doing a variety of different things. One is to provide liquid equity capital to the small local businesses so that they didn't have to finance with debt. Because one of the primary, the chief competitive advantage of large corporation is they can finance in the stock market with liquid equity and small businesses can't. So our theory was if you could have a publicly traded venture fund for your community that could finance privatizations of these kind, like water, small businesses, we would create a stock that literally could go up if the popsicle index went up.
Right.
Because literally, if I have a publicly traded stock for my community and I improve the environment or I improve energy self-sufficiency, or I prove the popsicle index, the stock will go up. And so we can create an incentive system where the well-being of the people and the life in a place is aligned with the finance, and both local and global investors can make money making that place wonderful and sort of healing whatever problems are in that place. And in fact, that's how I first came to the popsicle index, because when I was the assistant secretary of housing, I was told we had a $320 billion portfolio, and I was told by the Office of Management and Budget that we were bankrupt. So I did a sort of a crash actuarial analysis to figure out what would cause our, you know, us to get unbankrupt, and it turned out a rising popsicle index. So there's tremendous correlation between the financial performance of the equity and assets in a place and the popsicle index, believe it or not.
No, I believe that. Confidence in the economy is a palpable force. Well, that's where we'll suspend this conversation, this part of it, but we'll come back to what you want to ask Catherine Austin Fitz next on Coast to Coast AM. So this is your chance to ask the question that you've been worrying about, and I say that really very consciously because it seems like there's a lot to be worried about here, and maybe Catherine Austin Fitz can help put some of those concerns to bed and help you sleep a little bit better, but maybe not. Maybe the tapeworm economy, such as it is, has grown to the point where at this stage, all you can do is really think about some sort of escape hatch, something, a plan that will cover you and the people that you love in the worst case scenario. So I guess that brings me back to something I made notes on earlier in the show. In fact, my notes are very weird. I was just looking at them. Catherine Austin Fitz, and it says here, Jack Kemp, hemlines, power lines, red buttons, in enemy of the state. It's not an accurate depiction of what has happened. But I did make a note here on the same page, and it said just about that idea of triggers. As you read the news, as you crack the radio in the morning and you hear something happening, what are you worried about as an economist? What do you worry about? What's your greatest fear for what might be the first domino to fall in a greater economic disaster in the United States?
My greatest fear is that we don't have a meltdown. We've got an economy, I call it the slow burn, where we are able to extract subsidy by essentially stealing from that which is productive to keep that which is unproductive going. And the longer we do that, the worse things will get. You know, you kind of get to this Orwellian place where you turn on the corporate TV news and up is down and down is up, and, you know, and the lies pile up. And so to me, the worst thing that could happen is the slow burn continue, which is a steady inflation where our expenses continue to rise and our income keeps falling and we're squeezed. What will work to our advantage is for productivity to matter again. So in essence, if we did have a mark to market where instead of using our resources to pump up, think of it this way. My father was a surgeon, Ian, and what he taught me was that when the body isn't trying, he's a trauma expert, the blood will, the body will sort of hoard the blood and send it to the most precious organs. So it'll shut off the toes and the fingers and then the feet and the hands, but it will preserve the blood for the heart and the lungs. Right now we have an economy which is preserving the blood for the toes. And we need to get the blood back to the heart and the lungs. And so the question is, what series of conditions could happen that would cause people to start to shift their behavior? Right now, not only is the tapeworm economy supreme, but most of the people in America are supporting it. They wouldn't push the red button. And, you know, we are sending in every community, every county, every municipality, we're sweeping up all of our bank deposits and our savings, and we're shipping it off to Wall Street and to the financial centers in a way that kills the liquidity and the sort of the life in our communities and the fundamental productivity. So what will cause us to really shift? And I think what I'm hoping is we get the shift, and we'd be better off with a meltdown if the next day we woke up and it mattered to be productive again. Because remember, what all this government money is doing is financing non-productive behavior. We're paying, I did an analysis in 1997 where we did a sources and uses of all federal government money into the Philadelphia area, and what we realized is the federal government was spending $12 billion a year primarily to spend, you know, to pay people to do something that made them stupider. So whether it's corporate welfare or welfare, you're basically paying people to do things that doesn't create real powerful economic muscle. You know, I live in a county where one of our biggest businesses is prisons. If you have 2 million people in prison in America, you know, and Lord knows how many people watching them, that's not productive. You know, that's not making things that really build real equity and real muscle, and it requires massive amounts of government borrowing to fund it.
By the way, I'm not sure what you said there, but we're always grateful when the guests bleep themselves, so thank you for that. And then we'll get to your questions and comments coming up next. Get the shift before we get the shaft. That's what we're talking about. Catherine Austin Fitz next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. The lines are full. We'll get to everybody. We ask that since everybody does want to talk with Catherine Austin Fitz, that you keep your question as short as you can, but looking forward to your comments, too, on Coast to Coast AM. Ann is in California on the wild card line. Ann?
Hi. Well, I had originally wanted to ask your guest about something that was part of the minutiae she talked about, but now I really want to ask her a question about the thrust of her talk. So let me just say the other one real fast. I hope that if you can, you could make sure that Ruth Bader Ginsburg knows about the silent, supposedly non-lethal, probably electromagnetic radiation weaponry. And that was used on you. And people who listen to Coast know a lot about that. Anyway, the thing is, I wanted to ask, what form, if one were to try to put aside some metal, some gold and silver and so forth, what form should it be in? And, God, I'm so nervous. I can't remember what.
Okay, well, that's a lot right there. So don't worry, we'll get to that. I mean, yeah, what form should it be in? Just somebody holding it somewhere, and you have the certificate for it, or should you have it under your mattress?
Well, Well, there are many ways you can hold precious metals. You can hold physical, either under your own control or with a depository, and that depository can be in one or more places all around the world chosen for that reason. Or you can invest in stocks that represent an investment in precious metals. Or now you can hold digital gold. I use a service, goldmoney.com, where you can essentially have gold in a depository in London or Zurich, but you can also use that gold and transact and pay people with gold and receive payment in gold digitally through the internet. So it's basically physical possession, either in your possession or in a depository or through the through a brokerage firm. You can, there are various stocks that you can invest in, and then and digital gold. So there are many ways to do it, and it really comes down to what you're trying to accomplish. And you know, the watchword is always diversification, diversification, diversification. There's no perfect, there's no financial investment or tangible asset that can make up for the absence of community and the rule of law. So,
as long as it's a depository, not a suppository, I'm good with that. Wildcard line. Bob is also in California on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Bob?
Hey, love your humor. You're funnier now.
Thank you.
Yeah, Catherine, fantastic. You're definitely one of the good ones out there. You familiar with Gary Webb and you remember the newspaper stuff? Yeah, I used to work with the DEA agent named Hector Bareilles. You ever hear of him?
I believe so.
I'm lost.
I was trying to stay alive. I took a crash course and, in fact, wrote and got to meet Gary Webb because the sort of what he was writing about figured into my situation so much. But
well, who's the Hector guy? I don't know him, Bob.
Yeah, well, the Hector Bareilles, his DEA agent, he stumbled onto the CIA's operation of the laundering money, and I knew better. I backed off. You don't mess with the CIA, you disappear. But he had actually, they hit him up in Washington like they did you, so he wasn't murdered. They tried to murder him a couple times, so they hit him up in Washington. That's where they put you in a safe house out there too, correct?
Pardon me?
Were you ever in a safe house?
No.
They didn't.
Oh, you were.
Okay, because when you start investigating the CIA, people start disappearing. I know better than that. You know, when they gave me a threat, you know, I just said, you know, I just backed out and I just disappeared. But,
well, you know, I'm always surprised when I hear people say, why is it that nobody has tried to do anything? In fact, thousands of people have tried to do something, and the amount of people who've been killed or died mysteriously is very significant. So I am familiar with the death lists that were kept during the Clinton administration and also I think the Bush administration. But it's astonishing how many people continue to try and stop the corruption and deal with the corruption given how much violence there is and has been.
Well, go back if you would and fill in a little bit more of the blank of when you felt like you were at your most threatened. When did you feel least safe?
Well, the physical harassment went on and off for years. I was, during the litigation, part of it was, the process was 12 years. I had a series, when the litigation got very serious and I insisted on going to court, I had a series of poisonings. The first three were not, they were certainly debilitating, but they were not death-threatening or life-threatening. And then the last one was very life-threatening and very terrifying. So I would say that, I had people break into the house and follow me and run me off the road and all those kinds of things. But I think the most scary was the poisonings because they were so debilitating and it took many years of chelation and other things to recover from them.
So. Why wouldn't they just give you, why wouldn't they just give you a massive lethal dose of poison up front? I mean, something.
I don't know, because I'm absolutely convinced if somebody wants to kill me, it's relatively easy to do.
Right. So why? I mean, if you were posing a threat through a lawsuit, and they why go to all that extra to to destabilize your reputation?
Well, that's reputation. A very important question, because I couldn't fathom why what was happening because it didn't make economic sense to me. I mean, my estimate is the government spent about $45 million on all the audits, investigations, and litigation. I mean, it's just very high overhead. And having had a lot of experience with government contracting, I was able to sort of cost out what the time and the cost was to the government. So why would anybody spend $45 million when they could just kill somebody? It didn't
right
make logical sense to me. And that was part of, if you read the Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, it really comes down to brand. It's incredibly important to the health of the financial mechanisms that we've been talking about, that the average person believe in the rule of law. And so fantastic amounts of money, if you go back and read the history of COINTELPRO and some of this other stuff, fantastic amounts of money are spent to make a person like me look like they failed. So you do everything you can to get them to commit suicide or be driven crazy or to be debilitated. If you've ever seen the movie Gladiator, you know, the emperor poisons him so that he can look like he wins.
Right.
So you're doing everything you can to handicap the other person because you want to look like the winner. And it's very important to your sort of what the Chinese call your mandate of heaven. You want to have the, you know, you want the crowd to believe that you have the authority and you're truly the winner. So, you know, it was very important to make me look like I, you know, because normally in situations like that, when you come at somebody with that many audits and investigations, you're able to find something, you know, some parking ticket. And I don't think it ever occurred to them that they wouldn't be able to find something. And then it's interesting, at one point they seized our offices and sort of grabbed all of our databases and digital technology, and I think, I won't go into the story, but I think connected to the Gary Webb story, because we were putting up maps of the mortgage defaults in areas with high drug trafficking, including South Central LA, where Gary Webb was writing about. But they seized our offices, and now what was I going to do? Ian, help me out.
No, I don't know, but it's fascinating. I mean, because I think you were talking about how this, why they didn't just knock you off was the kind of the premise,
oh,
and you said that they were going to.
When they were in the building, they tried to falsify evidence,
okay,
and the property manager saw it and gave us an affidavit. And they went to extraordinary lengths to basically falsify evidence, and we got the affidavit, you know, telling the whole story of how they did it, and turned it into the courts. And the court said, "Oh, this is the special master said, oh, this is SOP." Well, I had no idea what they meant, so I called up one of the guys who used to work for the audit department of the Inspector General. I said, "What's SOP?" He said, "Standard Operating Procedure." When it turns out you're clean, to their surprise, and they can't find anything, you know, then they falsify evidence. Standard operating procedure.
Okay. Let's get to look. That part doesn't surprise me. I just sort of, it seems like they're spending a lot of time and effort. And I like what you're saying there, that it's easier, better to keep you alive and look like they defeated you,
well, you
than just you disappear.
How many people you kill? I mean, it's really bad for business.
I guess. Lorraine is on the wild card line in Maryland on Coast to Coast AM. Lorraine?
Hi. Thank you so much for all this. My question seems really naive and stupid now because Catherine, if I may call her that, has explained a lot of things. I was going to ask, that assuming we could get information out to the public generally, could there be a cocktail of solutions and we could overcome the financial threats that we have? But that seems like a stupid question because they don't want the information out, obviously.
Well, it's an excellent question because, in fact, there are many, many solutions. And if we all started, you know, it's pretty simple. Think of all centralization is bad. And all decentralization is good. And anything we can do to draw our time, our attention, and our money, our transactions, whether it's bank deposits, our purchases, our investments, and withdraw them from what I call the tapeworm, so large corporations and banks, and shift them to whether it's a local bank or a different kind of investments. I've got an audio seminar called Solari Portfolio Strategy, where I go into it in detail because it's not simple. But anything we can do to withdraw from the tapeworm and start to build outside the tapeworm in a healthy way, I mean, can you imagine, Ian, if just 10% of the American people said, that's it, we've had it, we're pulling our bank deposits from Citibank, bye-bye Citibank and the top big banks who've been running the government this way. It would be, the financial system is very leveraged, and people who think they have no money have no idea how much power they have if we started to act in concert and shifted the money, not, you know, away from the toes and started to shift it back to the heart and the brain. Because the country is full of honest people, both in government and the business sector, who are not being supported by the crowd. But as soon as the crowd starts to support them just by shifting their transactions, ooh la la, you can't imagine what could be unleashed. It's incredible.
Well, I'm probably the wrong guy to ask, because all of our family finances are invested in Hummel figurines, so we don't... we're just hoping the market goes back up again for them, and then we'll. All right, wild card line. Let's get to Christine in Washington on Coast to Coast AM. Christine,
oh, I'm still laughing at that last comment about Hummel figurines.
I wish it were a joke.
That was good. No, I decided that I need to start collecting money, so this is probably a good person for me to be talking to. But instead of asking a question, I actually just wanted to make a comment, and I'm just in awe of what you've been through and amazed at what a fantastic attitude you have. And you're just a delightful person with a great sense of humor, and it sounds like you've been able to get through a lot of stuff. So that's just great. And so it doesn't surprise me that they didn't succeed, because they probably thought the world would be a far worse off place without you in it.
Well, that's a very sweet thought, and you gotta like that. Yeah, I think you are the first 3-time poisoning victim we've ever had on Coast to Coast AM. I'm not sure. I'll have to ask that guest that question of future guests. But it's very interesting, and I'm sure that'll come up again as we get more questions and comments next on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. This is Ian Ponnett. Well, she's an investment advisor now, but at her heart still an economist, and a person who's helping us understand the tapeworm economy and to see the recent events of the last few days, some of the economic stories of this past week and how they are playing into an impression that we may be just glimpsing for the first time, many of us. About how dire things might be and what we can do to prevent going down with the tapeworm economy. Your questions and comments next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponnett.
Hey, have you got a sec? Yeah, I wanted to tell you about the Geek of the Week at CJOB.com. We've hired a geek to find all the very best on the web to keep you cool. Take a break right now. Get to know the Geek of the Week at CJOB.com and find a collection of the cool and sexy and the bizarre, the latest on the web this week.
Excuse me, can I take a break too?
Yeah, as soon as you find that website I told you about. You know the one. Oh yeah, and push up those glasses. The Geek of the Week at CJOB.com.
Have you seen your doctor or other healthcare professional for pain in your feet, knees, hips, or lower back? For your hands, wrists, shoulder, or for neck pain? If you have, Health West is a name you should know. Health West has been caring for Manitobans for over 18 years. So if you're suffering, call 783-3355 or 254-8600 today and begin enjoying a pain-free life again. Health West, caring for Manitobans in the Bay downtown and in Old St. Patel.
Tired of coming to your office only to find your expensive cleaning company doesn't even care enough to do a thorough and proper cleaning job? At A&E Building Maintenance, we'll take the time to do it right every time. We clean each space like it was our own and promise to clean up what your old cleaning company missed. A&E Building Maintenance is reliable, affordable, and have over 20 years of combined experience. Call us today at 339-5090 or visit our website at aeservices.ca. We clean what the other guys leave behind.
We're here with a local Winnipeg mother to talk about Teen Challenge, a treatment and training program for young men in need. Tell us, how did Teen Challenge help your family?
I've never felt such hopelessness and despair. After a year in their program, our son has a bright new outlook on life. If you suspect there is a problem, take action. Call Teen Challenge.
You can help support the young men at Teen Challenge by donating your car, boat, motorcycle, or RV. Call 1-800-632-6095 for more info.
This is Coast to Coast in Winnipeg, only on CJOB 68, the superstation.
Getting right back into the calls for Catherine Austin Fitz. We'll start with Peter west of the Rockies in Utah on Coast to Coast AM. Peter?
Yes. Hey, I've got a question. I understood you to say first off, a person could be paid in gold through gold money, but I am sort of confused on how that would actually work. I don't have sight, and I'm trying to sustain myself. I don't have too good income. In fact, I have subsidized disability income is all I get. But I was just wondering how a person could help. A person could improve their community and sustain themselves monetarily. And what about this being paid in gold?
Okay.
Well, you could only be paid if the person who wanted to pay you had a gold, had a gold money account and was using gold. So the transactions would be limited to people who were using the system. But in theory, the more and more, if you go to our website at solari.com, we have on the right-hand side a little calculator that will allow you to calculate out payments in dollars into precious metals. So if you wanted to pay somebody with gold and silver coins, you could use the calculator to figure out how to do it. And one of the things I encourage people to do is to do more and more as they can with gold and silver, because that means that we keep our balances for transactions in a currency which is going up in value as opposed to one that's going down in value. But again, you could only do it if you were transacting with somebody who also had an account.
I don't know her name, and I don't know that I'd even know her by face, but one of the major supermodels recently just said that she's only getting paid in any currency other than U.S. dollars.
Oh, I thought she stipulated euros.
Did she say euros? I think she
skimmed the article. It was she had a contract with Procter and Gamble with signing.
Oh, that's what it was.
Something.
That's what it was.
And she insisted on euros. Well, think about it. If you're making a contract today, and the dollar is dropping rapidly, and let's say it takes you a year to fulfill and get paid. It could be a significant portion of your profit on a contract.
And yet the Hummel figurines hold their value. First time caller line.
I would say it'd go up in value, Ian.
Well, it depends which one. The little boy fishing, that's a cute one. And we're banking our retirement on that. Alexandra is in Tennessee, not too far away from Catherine Austin Fitz on Coast to Coast AM. Alexandra?
Hi. I had a couple of related questions leading up to one big question. First of all, I missed how the lawsuit actually started, and I wondered how you had enough money to fight it, and also what the effects and the symptoms were of the, quote, invisible warfare. And then leading to the bigger tie-in with all the things you've been discussing, I'm convinced that the British and American governments have been working with the aliens, an alien agenda, literally underground, and I wonder what the true agenda ultimately is, and when that is eventually exposed, how that will affect the general populace, and how that's tied in with these disappearing dollars you're talking about, these prison camps that are popping up.
All right, you're throwing a lot of stuff here. Let's go ahead and see if we get some of those first ones answered. There's a lot there.
If you go to my website at solari.com and click on the Dylan Reed story, the case study, there is, at that website, there's a resource section, and if you look under the enterprises and organizations for Hamilton Securities, which was the name of the company, there's a link to the documents. It's dunwalkie.com/Gideon, and there's significant amounts of disclosure and documentation on the litigation. The way we paid for it was when it started, the company was very successful and I was very wealthy. And essentially, I liquidated and sold all my possessions and used all my money to deal with it. We also had an insurance policy that paid for some of it, but it was basically a combination of the company's assets, my willingness to sell all my possessions, et cetera, and then the insurance, and really the willingness to go 12 years without any income, which is, you know, is never advisable. But if you go to the Hamilton Securities litigation section at dunwalkie.com, or you can just link to it from Soleri.com, you will get more information than you ever wanted to know.
About that lawsuit.
Well, there were 12 lawsuits, but there were three primary, and the key one, which was the Court of Claims, we won. So,
I was just going to jump to the next caller, so that's all I was doing. So,
okay.
But East of the Rockies, Sam is in Michigan on Coast to Coast AM. Sam?
Hey, good morning. There are people, as Catherine has stated, that have... in fact, I think there's some of your colleagues, Rodney Stitch, defrauding America, Unfriendly Skies, Drugging of America. He was an FAA official. Let's see, then there was Colonel Dan Marvin, Expendable Elite. He fought the CIA. They wanted to take his book off the market, Expendable Elite, and he succeeded, and then his lawyers were fired. I wanted to ask Catherine whether... H.R. 1955 rings a bell because Ian, on a previous show...
I just read H.R. 1955.
Okay, and purportedly this fellow advanced the possibility that the government would attack the site's creators because of what they would label as domestic terrorism... whatever on the website.
Well, the challenge that we have is, we're kind of in a negative loop here. We have a population of 300 million people who are living vastly beyond our means, and we don't want to change. I mean, we have to take responsibility for this because it's not the American people do not want to push the red button. They want the party to continue. And so the problem is the only way that you can continue the party is with more and more control and more violence. I'm not saying that that's the only reason why it's happening, but we're in a downward spiral where we keep, doing things to get more subsidy to prop the system up. And as we do that, we make the system weaker, and then you need more control and more force. So that the key to getting out of this downward spiral is to kind of shift our mindset and spiral up, which is to start to get fundamental productivity working again. I mean, if we can hit the red button in our own communities and do it in a way that makes money for us, then we start to shift this thing enormously, because part of the move to the negative is everybody's fear that they can't trust the other party to act responsibly. And so far, if you wander around the world and you look at a lot of what's going on, you can see where that fear comes from, but that's something that we can shift. So as the system becomes more centralized, it becomes less and less stable, and that's the opportunity is to decentralize it.
Wildcard Line and Nathan is in Iowa on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Nathan?
Hi. I was wondering, like, the 401ks that we got, okay? We're dumping thousands and thousands of dollars, well, millions of dollars in there every week. So why ain't the stock market at like 200,000? What would happen if they didn't have all these 401ks going in there every week? I mean, it seems like right. It's overinflated.
Right, right. And unfortunately, what's been happening is, as you heard me talk about the money being pulled out of the country, is the smart money's been pulling out of the country and investing abroad. They've been able to do that because the 401ks are propping it up and holding it up. And more than the 401ks are pension funds. If you look at where the pension funds are invested, I think the big story that hasn't been told or discussed is the extent to which, you know, the news makes it sound like the mortgage losses are on Wall Street and the big banks. They're not. They're in our pension funds. So if you go look at what your state pension fund is, they're huge losses. They're huge losses that have yet to be announced or illuminated.
Wildcard line, Marty is in Ohio, where my alma mater did some really nice work today. Marty, you're talking with Catherine Austin Fitz.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask about, I've been sort of following this trend that, you know, you're talking about people going back to local communities and taking care of their family and themselves and everything, and that's happening a lot. But in the process, there's also this kind of developing fear, you know, that the people in the cities are not doing this, the same kind of thing. They're not preparing. They're not able to prepare. So they're going to sort of come after those people that are prepared, and there's this massive arming going on.
Like a haves and have-nots kind of a scenario.
Yeah, so that they, right. The have-nots will come after the food, you know, that you're growing on your little plot for your family and everything, and you are going to shoot them down. And I've had several people tell me that recently. And you can see that on the websites, you know, that's exactly, that's the plan. And so that's really, people are panicking, sort of. So they're kind of feeling like, you know, I've got to get in my bunker here, you know, because the people in the cities are going to, and it's just like, I think it's so unnecessary, you know, because people have had hard times in the past, you know, like in Europe went through everything. Their cities were bombed, you know, so, and they didn't turn into animals. Barbarism did not happen, you know, necessarily. So,
well, and I can't take responsibility for anybody else's website other than ours or maybe Catherine. So I'm with you, but I think I agree. I think there will always be people who will stir the pot, push it as far as they can into the area of fear, for their own amusement. So I think it's important to use your critical mind on that, and I'm glad you are. Catherine, did you want to make a comment on that, though?
Don't get me started on community prayer, but I think, what is amazing if you really dig in and look at how things work in any city, it's a miracle that there isn't more violence, and I think it's a testimony to how generous people are. I mean, in the last 5 years, I've been to all 50 states in this country, and I never cease to be amazed at how generous and kind, even under extraordinary circumstances, Americans are. Now, at the same time, we're very pressed for time, and we are used to miraculous conveniences compared to what our ancestors had to struggle with and deal with, and so it's so important that we don't go to fear, and but that's not to suggest that some won't become violent. And it just gets back to the fact that it's critical that I try to make money in a way that raises your popsicle index. We're going to have to start caring about each other, because it's the only way we're going to be able to get back to any kind of productive society and economy.
Bonnie is in New Orleans, where they experienced a little of that on Coast to Coast AM. Bonnie, you're talking with Catherine Austin Fitz.
Hi. We're seeing such an economic boom in this area because of all the rebuilding and stuff like that. What do you foresee for this? Because right now we're counting on immigrants. I mean, we have people, contractors that ride around, and if he sees immigrants on roof, people ask them how much they want, how much they're making, and then offer them a couple of dollars more. I mean, it's like you don't have enough workers. It's like, is it Karl Marx that talked about the superstructure and the structure? I mean, the superstructure is not keeping up with the structure at all. I mean,
Catherine, let's give Catherine a chance. Yeah, Catherine.
Well,
what do you
think? One of the things we're seeing is that the American economy is very dependent on immigration, and my prediction is immigration is going to continue to grow, and part of that is simply the immigration is really keeping the economy going. It's a very critical component to doing that. Now, the speed at which, you know, whether it's Americans moving around or immigration, is wreaking havoc on trying to create, you know, culture. So we're in a very depending on where you are, a very dynamic situation, because if you go down along the borders, which you'll find in many areas, the borders are just wide open. So you're talking about incredible rapid change for many communities. But I think immigration is here to stay, and it's going to grow and accelerate.
Well, and that brings us, I think, probably to Anna on the international line in Canada. Anna, you're talking with Catherine Austin Fitz.
Yes, thank you. And this is, I believe, the second time that I've heard you, Catherine. And I want to, you're absolutely amazing in terms of your courage, speaking about these matters and the resilience with which you have survived what's obviously been very challenging.
And let me ask you, as long as you're here, Catherine, what do you know about the tapeworm economy in Canada?
Well, Canada is in much better shape in many respects than the United States. You've got a smaller population and fantastic natural resources, and I think a more stable culture, although you have, you know, sort of boom times in certain places. But I think Canada is in a much better situation than the United States, and that may be why we're looking to merge into a North America union, because we have too much population and not enough natural resources compared to them.
Right.
So Canada's about to get merged with us, and I'm not sure the Canadians are particularly happy about it.
Well, we're not imminently too thrilled about that. That's been threatening over the last, 400 or 500 years, and it's going to be a bloodless takeover without a war, other than the economic one. But relative to this, I've been listening to you talk about gold money also, and have been doing a bit of investigating relative to your speaking about it, and was alarmed that they're connected to Barclays Bank in terms of funds coming in before they get converted.
Right.
Excuse me. And Barclays...
The banks they use are not my favorite banks at all.
Well, Barclays... But I understand Barclays is the only one that they use, and Barclays is, as of yesterday, heard a news item in which they're greatly affected by the subprime meltdown.
Well, all the banks... the whole banking system is greatly affected, and it's not just all the banks, but it's many investors, including many pension funds. It's the bond insurers, therefore it's the municipalities. The subprime meltdown is going to hit everybody and everything. And if you look at gold money's operation, and Barclays is one of the banks they use, it's not their primary bank. Essentially, what you're doing is you're buying gold or silver, and that's in a depository, which is not Barclays. They're private depositories. They're not part of the banking system. So that's the bedrock upon which it stands or doesn't stand.
Catherine Austin Fitz, always a pleasure. Solari.com is her website. You taught us a lot tonight, and I think a lot to mull over and sort out. But it's important, I think, to get information like this from somebody like you, who is immortal. Catherine Austin Fitz, she can't be killed, poisoned, shot, stabbed. She's the Rasputin of.
You know what's the last? My favorite line in the Bible is the last line of the Book of Job. You know what that is, Ian? It's just, and Job died old and full of days.
And full of days. Good. Well, I wish those to you, too. And thank you so much. God bless you. Have a great night. Looking forward to having you back on again soon. Hopefully it'll be for good news in the economy. Wouldn't that be a nice change? Deus te amat. And I do, too.